people don't seem to understand the realities that are on the ground in our communities. We have cities in Atlantic Canada with 30,000 people or more that have no Uber Eats, no Skip the Dishes, no Uber in general, because there's just nobody to do those jobs. Because as you know, many, many, many of those jobs are held by newcomers, and many of them are temporary non-permanent residents. And so if you go to Toronto, you'll have 10 different services to deliver the food to your door. But if you go to a 30,000 person city like Miramichi in New Brunswick, you have...
Welcome back to the e-commerce podcast, people. Again, I have a bad voice for at this point in time in my life. But again, it happens to everyone, I guess. If you live in Canada and you experience winter, you're going to get the flu or something. But today, I'm really excited for today's guest. I have with me David Campbell, an economist. I mean, he's fully focused on the economic side of Atlantic Canada. But I feel like the lessons that he shares apply to across the country, to be honest. He also runs Jupia Consultant, so check him out. His Substack is amazing if you want to learn about all things Atlantic Canada. Welcome to the Newcomers Podcast, David.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
I'll get right into it, like the deep end. You know, there's this thing that's happening right now where it feels like we're having this conversation about immigration as it's the cause or the solution to Canada's economic challenges. And it just feels like everyone either talks about it depending on what side they stand in that thing. Some people, it's, oh, every single thing they say, immigration is the solution. For some other people, it's, oh, immigration is the problem. I think for me is, I want to explore the nuance there because I feel like it's just some nuance there. It's not exactly black and white, you know, and I was hoping to kind of explore that with you.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to discuss it with you. At a high level, the reality is it's a large country with a lot of different economic and population realities from one end to the other. And the other thing is we had this surge of non-permanent residents in the last few years, and people have confused non-permanent residents with immigrants. So those are that's sort of the two big sort of issues that have come out in the last couple of years. Is that we're confusing non-permanent residents with immigrants. An immigrant in Canada is somebody that is a permanent resident or that lives in Canada and was born in another country. So a non-permanent resident, many of them want to stay in Canada and many of them will stay in Canada permanently, but they're not here permanently. And so I make the point that in many ways, they're not a lot different than a tourist. And every year we attract, I think it's like 19 million tourists or something come to the country, and we don't add them to the population. So I think whenever you're going to debate an issue, you have to start with facts. And so the facts are we have radically different economic realities and demographic realities across the country. And so a national approach where you just say we're going to cut the number of immigrants coming to the country and sort of apply that across the country, it makes no sense. I'll give you one example on that front. So in Peel County, which is Mississauga, last year there were 169 births for every 100 deaths. So in other words, if Peel did not attract a single immigrant, they would have 69 more people every year for every 100 that die. Okay. In a place called Queens County, New Brunswick, which is a rural county in New Brunswick, there were 41 births for every 100 deaths. So every year the population shrinks, right, significantly every year, unless they can attract people to move there. And they have an economy that needs people. They have a forest industry. They have sawmills. They have all kinds of industry, but they're running out of people. And so to say, well, we're going to treat Peel the same as we treat Queens County, New Brunswick, makes absolutely no sense. So all I've been calling for is sort of a rational approach to immigration, looking at the national landscape and saying, where do we need immigrants? Now, if Peel wants to continue attracting immigrants, that's fine. That's their call. It should be. But I know Toronto quite well. That part of the country is kind of congested right now and has some issues with the massive population growth. The transportation infrastructure is stressed. You know, there's a lot of homelessness. There's a lot of issues associated with rapid population growth in that part of Canada. So fine. If you want to reduce immigration in Peel for a few years to sort of let things settle, good for you. But don't take the same approach in parts of the country where we actually desperately need newcomers to the country. So that's one thing. And then the other issue is around the temporary folks in Canada, and those are either international students. Many of them are international students that graduated and now are on work permits, either open work permits or restricted work permits. And so the goal there, again, is to reduce that number significantly. And they've started to do that. And that's why Ontario's population basically stagnated last year, because of that reduction of the non-permanent residents. But even in that case, if you take small communities in Ontario that desperately need those workers, places like Chatham-Kent and Sarnia, why treat them exactly the same way as you treat, again, Mississauga? So I just think that, yes, this is a big country with lots of different needs and realities, and national immigration strategies should be based on provincial and local realities. And then you roll that up and you have a more rational approach, I think, to immigration moving forward. So I'm trying to make this case to the powers that be, both provincially and nationally, and I use my platform to do that. But I also have many discussions with officials, and hopefully we're going to get that through. If there are communities in this country that actually want to reduce immigration, and if that's the will of the people in that community, good, go for it. As long as you understand the impacts and what the implications of that are going to be. But for those areas of the country that understand that we need a moderate flow of newcomers into the country to provide the workforce to help us rebuild our population base, I think it's fundamental to the growth of this country moving forward.
Yeah. That point you make about how you break them, like split them into the non-permanent residents and the permanent residents, is really interesting, because there's this thing where for a while you feel like Canada, and I'm being very careful here in the sense that we've probably moved on from that as a country, but at some point we told these people, come, study, and stay. And so there was just that sense of, oh, I just had to come in as a student and I would stay. And I wonder if what has happened here is because humans behave to the human being is like, oh, you know what? I'm immigrating to Canada. Like, because all I was told was I would come here, I would study, and then I would have a chance to stay. Yeah. And so everyone's now reacting to that. Oh, well, why have you changed that on me right now?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a few things I would say to that. One is, it's mathematically impossible to bring in 1.5 million students and only admit 400,000 or 500,000 people as permanent residents. You have three people coming here for every one that you might admit as a permanent resident. So I think we should have been more honest with people, that, you know, coming to Canada to study is a pathway. And by the way, I think it's an incredibly important pathway. Yeah. If you get education here, if you get a college degree, a diploma, or a university degree here, it should really help you on your pathway into the workforce and so on. And plus, while you're studying, you can work and play an important role in the workforce. A lot of international students do work, and they play an important part in the regional workforce situation. So it's all good. But at the end of the day, if you bring in 2 million international students and you bring in 2 million more every year, and they all want to come to Canada, it becomes impossible, because your permanent resident admissions are only, well, now they're dropping them below 400,000. But let's say you kept them where I think they should be, closer to 500,000. You would still not have enough slots for every single person. So now what you can do, of course, is you can do what they've tried to do and say, okay, well, you can work on a work permit, and then maybe two or three years down the road, maybe you'll get your permanent residency. But at the end of the day, if you bring so many people into the post-secondary education system that you don't have enough slots for them on the PR side, there's not a lot of people. And I think it would be difficult to admit, let's say, 1 million people a year as permanent residents in a small country like this. So I still think there has to be some a measured number there. I think that number is closer to 500,000 and should grow every year because of the demographic realities we face in this country. But if we said tomorrow, let's bring in 2 million on a population base of 400 million or 40 million, I think it would be difficult. So yes, I think we should have been more honest with people, the international students. We should have said that this is a pathway, but it's not a guaranteed pathway. Then I think it would have been more fair for them, because you're right. I think many of them came for, not all, but many of them came to use education as a pathway. And now many of them are stuck with these permits. Yeah. And by the way, we're starting to hear more and more being sent home. And what's frustrating to me is that even people that have a good job in their career, but they're not a permanent resident, they're on a work permit. When the work permit's expiring, they're being sent home. And what happened was, in the past, if you had a work permit and you were in a career job, let's say, you know, the permit came up, you just renewed it, right? Your sponsoring company would say, hey, this person's doing an important job for us, let's just renew it. And many of these people are now being sent home. And I think that's a huge shame for them and for the country.
I think that's the frustrating thing for me about the system. And I honestly don't know what the answer is. Like, I think the first one is what you said about how we need to have a better conversation about Canada is not one. Like, it's Canada is one country, but we have 13 provinces and all that. And every province is different, has different needs. And can we just approach it that way to some extent? Because like this example you just gave now, where someone is in here already, is contributing to the economy already, is paying taxes in some way. But because we have taken the conversation to a numbers conversation, oh, we need to send 500,000 people home. Oh, no, 5 million people must go home. And then what's just happening is that every single conversation we're having is looked through that lens of, well, your permit is over, go, just goodbye. Like, no one is saying, okay, what does that mean? Like, what is this person's lifetime yeah. value from a tax point of view, just from what we have of who they are right now? No one is having that conversation.
Yeah.
What does the city need this kind of talent right now? No one is having that conversation. And so it's just like, I think that's what frustrates me a lot when I talk about these things. But I really like how you explained the part about the numbers, because I had never seen it that way. And it kind of now makes sense also why public trust kind of fell, because you're right. If you're 40 million people still growing, public infrastructure hasn't yet exactly caught up with the number, and then you're bringing in 2 million people a year, that is a recipe for civil war to some extent in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, anyway, I think it's a complicated issue. But one of the issues that we've seen is that because you have so many people on the open work permit, so many international folks, it did look like the unemployment rate among young Canadians went up in the summer. And so this is a recipe for disaster. It's not the fault of the newcomer. It's not the fault of the international student. It's not the fault of the international graduate. But if they are working in jobs in coffee shops, in restaurants, in any sector that normally would have been taken, let's say, by a summer student, and if the unemployment rate goes up, and we did see that in many places in the country, it looks like the newcomer is taking the Canadian's job, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the, you know, if you got the parents of the high school kid and little Johnny and little Janie can't get their job, the normal job that they got in the summer, you know, then that might turn them against immigration. So I think, you know, maybe we overdid it, bringing in the too many international students for the system to handle it. But as I said before, even that, if you go province by province, you have different realities. New Brunswick had the lowest number of people in post-secondary education relative to the size of the workforce of any province in the country. And BC and Ontario had the highest. So why should you cut everybody the same, right? Or why do you have this national approach, right? So this is the, again, part of the problem. You need to be able to isolate where, you know, the cuts you make might actually hurt an area, but it actually might be beneficial to another area. But I think is that the general rule is we need to have some parameters around how many people come in, both as permanent residents and also as temporary residents. We need to know, you know, we need to have some sort of strategy around that. And I think one of the things we didn't do, what happened was, just to recap, after the pandemic, a lot of employers, particularly in the service industries like restaurants, came to the government and said, the kids aren't coming back. They're not coming back to work. It's post-COVID. We can't find any workers. If you look at the data, the number of job vacancies tripled right after. So if you look at 2022, the job vacancy rate tripled across the country. Everybody panicked. And the government said, okay, let's just bring in a whole lot more international students and give them work permits so they can work while they're studying and they can work after. And by the way, they can bring their wife or their husband and they can work. And if they have, you know, teenage kids, teenage kids can get work permits. So that, you know, so that flooded in. And by the way, it solved that problem. So the unemployment rate went down, the vacancy rate went down, the job vacancy rate went down. But like I said, it looks like we maybe overdid it in certain parts of the country. Yeah. And you ended up with higher unemployment among the permanent residents or the Canadians. And that's not where you want to be. You want to be in a situation where the temporary population is filling a need in the market. And in a lot of parts of the country, that was the case. In some parts of the country, it looks like we maybe overdid it a bit.
I want to go to that disparity that we always see between the provinces. And because you've done a lot of work in Atlantic Canada, so we'll kind of use that as our test case. Like, what does it really look like? And how do we even stop that? Because I have a friend actually who just moved to Calgary from New Brunswick. Like, I helped them find a house. You know, I have in Calgary. And I see that happen where people move to that place and then after like 3-4 years, they move out. The argument they make is less economic opportunities and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I want to understand the other side of it, which is like, what does this sound like from an economic point of view? Why that is probably happening?
Yeah.
How we can even stop that? Because, I mean, when an immigrant comes to you and says, "Look, I feel like I could get a better job in Calgary," I can't say to them, "No, stay in New Brunswick because the city, the place needs people." I'm like, "Oh yeah, sure, I get you. Like, you want opportunities," but I'm like, I feel like there's also, which is why I was excited to talk to you, was there's also the other part of that thing is, why is that happening? Yeah. Why is that? Because humans just want to survive, like, right?
Sure. So there's a few things. First of all, before I answer that question, I want to tell you that the city of Toronto almost every year has a negative interprovincial migration rate. In other words, more people move out of Toronto than move into Toronto from other parts of Canada every year. The way Toronto makes up by that is by attracting 90,000 immigrants every year. So a lot of cities, large and small, lots of people move in, lots of people move out every year. It's a little more pronounced. You could see it more in smaller cities, like in like St. John, New Brunswick, or whatever. But if you look at the data, big cities like Toronto even lose a lot of people. People that, let's say they live in Toronto and now they want to have kids. So yeah. They say, okay, I'm not going to have kids in the city of Toronto, so I move to London, Ontario, or I move to wherever. So that's one thing you need to understand. The other thing is, if you look at Moncton and Calgary, for example, the migration rate between those two in recent years has been favorable to Moncton. In other words, more people have moved to Moncton from Calgary than have moved from Calgary to Moncton than from Moncton to Calgary. So you've talked to somebody that moved to Calgary. I can talk to people that have moved from Calgary. But the bottom line is, and I've been saying this since I've been writing about immigration for 15 years, is the number one reason why an immigrant will stay in your community is economic. You can forget about all the other stuff, right? Yeah. Forget about the nightlife and forget about all this other stuff. Forget about the snow hills. If they don't have an economic opportunity that matches their skills and education and interests, they won't stay in the long run. And so I think that's just a question of trying to do a better job of trying to align the immigrant attraction effort to the jobs and the opportunities on offer, and trying to do a better job of that, but also understanding that just in general, small cities, small communities are always going to have more of a challenge when it comes to that because they just don't have the range of opportunities.
Yeah.
So if you go to Calgary, you have a lot more competition. A larger workforce, but you do have a larger range of opportunities. So I would just say, and this has been the problem in the past. So if you think about the points system, and this is one of the things that people want to bring back, this idea that you should only bring in immigrants that speak three languages, have a master's degree, and have 10 years experience in this sector, okay? And then, so this is a very true story. So what would happen is these people would come to New Brunswick, they'd get all the points, and then they'd drive taxis. So,
and they'll be frustrated.
Right. So if you want a taxi driver, then bring in a taxi driver. Don't bring in a medical doctor to drive taxis. So we one of the things we changed in 2017, and I had some small part in that, is we tried to say that immigration policies should be flexible to the needs in a community. So if you need, you know, manufacturing workers, you should be able to bring in manufacturing workers. If you need to bring in truckers, you should be able to bring in truckers. But that old point system, it was biased toward highly skilled and highly educated immigrants. And I don't have a problem with highly skilled and highly educated immigrants. That's wonderful. We need them in this country. But if they come into a place like New Brunswick and end up working in jobs that are completely misaligned with their skills, they're going to leave. Yeah. I used to know a guy that ran a manufacturing firm in Moncton, and he was so impressed that he had people with immigrants with master's degrees working on his assembly line. And I said, are you crazy? Like, they're not going to stay. They're going to stay as long as they get their PR, to get the PR, let's say. But they're not going to stay because they're not, if you have a master's degree, you're overqualified to work in assembly line, assembling little mechanical devices. So I just think, and that, by the way, that's a problem across the country. But it's easier in Ontario, because in Ontario, if you look at the annual flow of immigrants and you look at the ones that come as economic migrants, it's a much lower share in Ontario because they have a much higher family class immigrants and much higher refugees. And family class and refugee claimants do not have an economic requirement, right? You don't have to meet all these points.
Yeah.
And so what you have now is this weird situation where companies are closing in Moncton, let's say, and opening up in Brampton because it's easier to get workers in Brampton than it is in Moncton. For this very reason, as I told you. So this is the reality. And again, it comes back to this issue of regional realities. Yeah. But if you can get immigrant workers in Brampton easier than you can get them in Moncton, well, you just close the Moncton facility, you put it in Brampton, you produce the product in Brampton, and then you ship it by truck, by the way, with an immigrant driver in that truck, to New Brunswick for distribution. But New Brunswick loses the economic opportunity, loses the tax revenue that comes from it, all because you have a misaligned and not fit for purpose immigration system. So I don't know how deep you want to go, Dozy, with our discussion, that's a very, very important consideration for sure.
It is. Thanks again, because I feel like we people talk about it and we don't fully understand it this way, you know, because. As you were talking, I was thinking about something I read in the book where I think someone said, what gets measured gets managed, something like that. And it's kind of tied to how it's like the cobra story in India, where you're like, you know what, everyone bring cobras. And then, we'll pay you if you catch cobras. And then everyone starts to rear cobras in their house because they want to get paid for cobras. And it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, the points, or, you know, you want points? Okay, I'm going to give you the points. And then I will come because I want to get a PR. I get the PR and then I'll leave. And then in the end, the city says, oh, I got 10,000 immigrants. No, you didn't get 10,000 immigrants. You got 10,000 temporary workers who had a plan to move somewhere else. Like, they were TFWs in your city. Their PR is for another city that's where they want to use it for.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's a, people don't seem to understand the realities that are on the ground in our communities. We have cities in Atlantic Canada with 30,000 people or more that have no Uber Eats, no Skip the Dishes, no Uber in general, because there's just nobody to do those jobs. Because as you know, many, many, many of those jobs are held by newcomers, and many of them are temporary non-permanent residents. And so if you go to Toronto, you'll have 10 different services to deliver the food to your door. But if you go to a 30,000 person city like Miramichi in New Brunswick, you have zero, because you don't have any immigrants. So this is just, again, it's another reality. And I'm not saying we flood in a whole bunch of Uber drivers to Miramichi, but what I'm saying is that in a you don't want a situation where Toronto has the most dynamic labor market and small cities in Atlantic Canada or small cities in Western Canada have very dysfunctional labor markets where you don't even have enough people to drive taxis. So this is what we're trying to figure out as a country as we move forward. But you're in a situation now, like, and this has totally changed. 20 years ago, companies were leaving Toronto because it was easier to find workers in Moncton and Halifax. They were literally closing their operation in Toronto and opening their operation in Moncton and Halifax. And now, 20 years later, they're closing their operation in Moncton and opening it in Toronto, more specifically places like Brampton. So this is what has changed. Fundamentally, what has changed is immigration. So we need to have a policy and an approach that that reflects the realities on the ground in the provinces and in the cities across the country. Because, you know, Moncton deserves Uber drivers just as much as Toronto, and Halifax deserves, you know, long haul truckers just as much as Toronto. And if you want to have a dynamic and successful country like Canada, you've got to have, you know, growing population across the country to meet the demographic realities.
Yeah, it does. Like, is there, I want to go to productivity, but is there really an answer to it? Like, because yes, I think small cities will always be small cities. But is there really a way you make it easier to say certain people come and they stay? Like they literally stay and it becomes home for them.
Well, there's in many parts of the world, there's economic benefits if you set up in certain parts, smaller cities, for example, in Australia and other places. So you can make it, you can give economic incentives or tax breaks for people to stay. We don't do that in Canada at all, but at a very minimum, as I said, we need to be aligning immigration better so that if an immigrant comes to Moncton and they're working in their career, let's say they're an accountant, let's say they're a lawyer, let's say they're a doctor, let's say they're a truck driver, doesn't matter, as long as they're working in a career job and satisfied in that job, then there's not a lot of reason to move to Calgary. Now, you know, a truck driver in Calgary might make a little more money, but maybe they're going to face a higher cost of living. Now, one of the things that people say is, well, a lot of immigrants want to move to Toronto, let's say, because that's where there's a larger diaspora. There's a larger community of like-minded people. And that's fine. Again, I don't know the answer to that question, except to say that places like Halifax, Moncton, et cetera, Fredericton, need to build up some of these communities, some of these immigrant communities, so that people can feel at home in the community. But you got to start somewhere. That's no reason not to try and attract immigrants. So if we have some very impressive Filipino communities in this part of the country, we have Franco-African communities, specifically in New Brunswick, that are growing because of the French-speaking population here. So at the end of the day, in my view, if you've got a job that's aligned with your education, your skills, and your interests, you got a pretty good chance of staying. And by the way, Dozy, Atlantic Canada historically hasn't kept one third of its own young people. So how can you expect it to keep immigrants? Like, want, because it's a small market, right? These are small urban. A lot of Atlantic Canadian kids want to leave and go live in Toronto and Calgary and Vancouver and New York and LA and every in London. And, you know, they want to leave and they want to see the world and whatever. Some of them come back. But if, you know, you're putting too much of a burden on the immigrant population, so, well, you can't even keep one third of your own population, your own kids, but you're going to expect a higher retention rate among immigrants. It doesn't make any sense. So you're going to lose some, you know, just make sure you're doing a better job of aligning who's coming in to and making sure that they've got a good economic opportunity. And by the way, some of that can be entrepreneurship. We know that immigrants tend to be more entrepreneurial. If you look at self-employment and you correlate it with immigrant status, immigrants tend to be much more oriented toward owning businesses. We can talk about that as well, which I think is a really good thing. They've really been helping the startup community and the entrepreneurial community in Atlantic Canada. But at the end of the day, some of them are going to leave. Many of them are going to leave. And there's not a whole lot we can do, right? Except to say, we want you here, but we want to make sure you want to be here and you're earning a decent income and you're, you know, it's aligned with your skills and interests. And at the end of the day, if your job or your career or your family takes you to Calgary, you know, you're going to be joining a whole bunch of Maritimers out in Calgary anyway. So Say hi to them for us. No, if you go to Fort McMurray, if you go to the oil sands in the north of Edmonton, half the people up there are from Newfoundland and Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. You know, they moved out there. There was not enough workers. And so they moved out there for, you know, very high paying jobs in the oil sands. So, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. So hopefully, I like to say for every one that leaves, as long as you have 1.2 moving back, you know, you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to think of it, actually. It's a good way to think of it. Because, yeah, you know, even Calgary won't keep everyone. Like, everyone won't stay in Calgary. I mean, yeah. I landed in Ottawa. I was supposed to stay in Toronto. I was like, nah, I'm not going to live in Toronto. We landed in Ottawa. After 6 months, we were like, nah, we're not staying here. And we moved out to Calgary. And we kind of know that at some point, we'll probably leave Calgary. I don't know where, but we know that I'm enjoying the city of Toronto right now. I love it. But I know at some point, we'll be like, yeah, maybe it's time to go.
I want to talk about production. Can I say one other thing, Dozy, about that?
Yeah.
Labor mobility is one of the most important things in a country. Like, you have to have people that are migratory within the country. Otherwise, you get areas with high unemployment, sort of structurally high unemployment, and you get a lot of dysfunction. And you see more of that in the United States. It's a lot harder to move around, or people move around a lot less. And so you get areas like Appalachia where there's not a lot of economic opportunity, but people stay anyway, and then they just get bitter and angry and frustrated. And then you get J.D. Vance and you get Donald Trump. So labor mobility, right? This situation where I live in Summerside, Prince Edward Island, and I'm not happy with my job. Yeah. So I'm going to go online and I'm going to find a job in Edmonton. And man, that's a great job for me. And I'm going to move to Edmonton and it's easy. There's no barriers for me to move to Edmonton, let's say. That's important. And so I think labor mobility in a country like Canada is incredibly important. Now, places like Moncton and Summerside and Charlottetown should be doing everything they can to be really great places to live so that people don't leave. But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have labor mobility, if people like Dozy don't say, well, you know what, I'm not happy here, I'm going to move over there, but I really can't move because they don't let podcasters, you know, work in Calgary. They only let podcasters work in Toronto. That's a mistake. So I do think that one of the underlying things here is we have to ensure that Canada is a place where people can move until they find the place they want to settle. And we see that with immigrants, right? They come to Toronto, they stay a few years, they end up in London, or they end up in Chatham-Kent, or they end up in Windsor, or maybe they even end up in Moncton. And that's fine. You know, you got to find the place that works for you and your family from a cost perspective, from a career perspective, from a community perspective. And that's what I want for Canada. I want it to be a place where people are moving, where, you know, and ended up where they think is the best place for them and their family, and not being locked in some community that they really don't want to be.
You know, this is an aside, but I'm beginning to ask myself, why didn't I continue doing economics? Because it's interesting how, got into this immigration thing. I buy a lot of books on economics and stuff, but I've been buying the books that are like, I have one that talks about edible economics, how food is a way to think of economics. One on how coffee and wine and all that I would think of economics. Why I said that was because of what you talked about, labor mobility, and how it kind of starts to describe some of the disenchantment you see with people in certain communities and stuff, because you can't move. You're stuck there. You can't pay your bills, and so you're angry. And so the question is, once someone says, "Oh, XYZ is to blame for that," it's so easy to believe them because, yeah, you know, I mean, you look at your situation, you look at that person, and you're like, "Wait, well, I need someone to blame for what's going on with me."
Yeah,
you know, interesting for me is like economics is so interesting because it's really studying the human being. That's what it feels like. It's like, because just as you talk about it and all the little insights you've been dropping all the while, I'm like, okay, I should have done economics.
Well, it's not for everybody. It can be pretty boring studying numbers, analyzing data every day. But I think it's important for us to understand the facts. Because one of the problems, Dozy, you know, and you, I don't know, I think you wanted to ask about this, but there are a number of sort of Canadians, multi-generational Canadians that are turning against immigration. We're seeing it on social media. We're seeing it in even in the polling. If you look at Atlantic Canada, just 2 years ago, 60 to 70% of Atlantic Canadians when polled, when asked the question, do we have too many immigrants or not enough immigrants, upwards of 70% said not enough. In other words, we need more to make sure we have the population we need in our community. Just in the last 2 years, it's gone the other way. So over 50% in the Maritime provinces, I don't know about Newfoundland, Labrador, in the Maritime provinces, over 50% of people polled say we have too many immigrants, which is very sad considering the fact that we actually have, relatively speaking, relative to the population, we actually have fairly, you know, relatively few immigrants in this region. It's but it's all based on this misinformation. It's all based on if you, you know, I did a presentation the other day on this topic. And before I did my presentation, I went on X and I just wanted to do a little search. And you know how bad that platform has gotten, but it was terrible. It was immigrants all get, you know, $30,000 a year, free money. And I can't even, my parents are starving and immigrants get $30,000 each. And, you know, just like complete lies, complete fabrications or distortions of truth and very hateful and racist even. Anyway, I had to stop, right? I looked at it for like 5 minutes and my brain was sort of melting and dribbling out my ear because I was so depressed by what I read. But then I realized that you have hundreds of thousands of Canadians that go on social media. And if they're believing that stuff, even some of it, it's a really bad situation. So if I could sit down with every single Canadian in their living room and have a cup of coffee and just talk to them about our situation, I think we could make the world a better place.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. X is horrible. Like, I don't go there anymore that much. Still kind of staying on this in a way, but this is now kind of productivity. Like, everyone, like, it feels like that's, and I feel like they're kind of linked, the regional variations and the number population that we talk about all the time. Because everyone these days, I feel like the one big thing we get flogged with as Canadians is our productivity is low. America is way much faster. We don't innovate enough. And then when we bring it to immigration, some people say, oh, it can help us. The talent can help us. Some people say, no, immigration is a way to, it will suppress wage growth. You know, we should rather go automation and all that stuff. And I'm just like, what's your stance on that?
So there's two things that people don't understand. One is you have to look at it industry by industry. There are very productive industries. And when I say productive, it means they generate a lot more value added or output per hour worked than others. So a mine generates 10 times or 15 times more output per hour worked than a retail store in the Eaton Center. Okay. And so the mine is extremely productive in terms of the output per hour worked, labor productivity, and the retail shop is not that productive. Okay. And so if you have an economy that's not growing its highly productive sectors, and another sort of a synonym really would be capital intensive industries, because what happens is with these industries that you have to spend a lot of capital, billions of dollars in capital, they are very, very productive, because then as they go year to year, that you have a lot less labor required to do the work. And so the productivity is extremely high. So we haven't seen a lot of growth in our high productivity sectors, and we've seen growth in our low productivity sectors. And that's why overall Canada hasn't really been growing its productivity. Now, at the same time, you can see productivity growth in all the sectors, high productivity sectors and low productivity sectors. We're actually seeing productivity declines in the auto sector, which has been concerning me a lot, because now we're seeing that investment moving to the United States. So Trump has exacerbated a problem that was underlying, and that is we were losing, productivity was getting worse in the auto sector. But at the end of the day, we can try to grow productivity. But the issue with immigration, to bring it to your question, is if you are trying to drive productivity and you think that having too many immigrants is actually reducing your productivity, at the end of the day, in my opinion, to what you were saying earlier, is immigrants can actually help with the productivity because they can provide the labor to grow higher productivity sectors. So, for example, in a place like New Brunswick, we're trying to attract more mining investment. We're trying to attract more manufacturing investment. We're trying to attract more IT investment. And these are all sectors that are well above average in terms of productivity. So if you don't have the workers to grow those sectors, it's going to be very, very hard. Now, yeah. The low productivity sectors, sure, AI and automation can drive productivity. There's no doubt if we wake up tomorrow and every truck on the road is auto-driven, right? It's automatic driver, right? We've got this driverless trucks. You're going to have to deal with the 500,000 truck drivers that you put out of work. But at the end of the day, that sector is going to be a lot more productive because, again, you have a lot less labor requirement for the output. So I don't think the two are linked. And the other thing I would say on that, which is very frustrating, is that what's happening is, you're seeing economists advocate for reducing the labor pool, reducing the number of immigrants, let's say, because that'll squeeze the manufacturers and force them to invest in automation. So if you look at Japan, for example, which does not allow immigration, they have seen productivity gains because you have to. You just don't have the workers. And so what happens is you go to a restaurant in Japan, many restaurants, you don't ever see anybody. You sit at the table, you pay at the table, you order at the table through a digital device, on a conveyor belt, your food comes out, you eat your food, you pay and you leave, right? So you never actually see any bodies. I'm not sure that's a particularly pleasurable eating out. You may as well eat at home if that's going to be eating out, but you're certainly more productive. But my point is, when you have a country like Canada with this unequal distribution of immigration policies, you have what I just told you earlier. You have New Brunswick firms saying, well, you know what? I can't find workers. And what they want me to do is invest $100 million in machinery. But no, I'm just going to move to Brampton, where I don't have to invest in the machinery and I can get cheap labor. Hmm. So the reality is, unless you have a national approach, if you're in a situation where one part of the country has a surplus in labor and one part of the country has a deficit in labor, in the deficit, they're not going to invest in automation and productivity. They're going to move to the place where they can get the cheap labor. And that's exactly what we've seen in this country. We've seen a lot of businesses pick up and move from Atlantic Canada and expand their business, not only in Central Canada, but also in the U.S. And we're seeing more and more of that. And part of that is just a lack of labor. So if this idea of squeezing labor, reducing the labor, because you're going to force everybody to invest in productivity, in my opinion, hasn't worked. It's actually made things worse. So what you really need to do is sit down with your industries and say, okay, what kind of workforce do you need for the future? Let's talk about that. And let's make sure we've got immigration policies and educational policies to support that. And let's also talk about AI and automation. How do we improve the situation by using technology? But by blackmailing them or trying to leverage them by squeezing labor, it seems to me that hasn't worked.
It hasn't at all.
No, New Brunswick is less productive than Ontario, even though Ontario has brought in all these millions and millions of immigrants. So explain that to me. I'll tell you that that link is just not there. Now, again, if you took the entire country of Canada and you just said no more immigrants, ever, we're not going to attract a single immigrant, you would definitely force some firms to invest in productivity. Yeah. But you'd also force a whole bunch of firms to close, completely close, or move to another country.
Yeah.
And you would do irreparable damage to the economy. Canada, the other point I wanted to make to you, Canada is one of the most sparsely populated countries in the world. We have 41, 42 million people over this massive landmass, much larger than the United States. The United States has 330, 340 million people in an area that's smaller than Canada. And you have this massive country with very few people, and most of them are concentrated in a few large urban centers. Yeah. And yet we want to have high quality public services and roads and infrastructure across the entire country. You just can't do it. So you absolutely have to grow the population in a moderate way, grow the workforce in order to build these new industries and grow the GDP of the country. Otherwise, we're going to be in big trouble because we've done it for years. We've used immigration as a way to grow the economy since the Second World War and even before that, really. And in the last few years, we've done a much better job, I think, except this little post-COVID issue.
Yeah.
I think we've done a much better effort at aligning. Let me tell you one other story quick before I'm hoarding all of the time here, but I apologize.
No,
so
I'm enjoying the lessons.
If you look at the immigration rate, so that's the number of permanent residents admitted per 10,000 population, okay? We do that to compare Toronto to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at it before and after COVID, so 2019 and today, the areas that have benefited from the increase in immigration, almost without exception, have been these smaller communities. So the immigration rate in Toronto went up a little bit. The immigration rate in Edmundston, New Brunswick, was higher than it was in Toronto. Edmundston is just a small place of 20,000 people, okay? But the rate of immigrants was higher than Toronto. And if you look across the entire country, Summerside, PEI, Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, Moncton, New Brunswick, all had immigration rates higher than Toronto. So if you look at the beneficiaries, it's been these smaller communities. Hasn't been Toronto. Now, Toronto's been flooded with the non-permanent residents that we just talked about.
Yeah.
But if you look at the permanent resident rate, it's actually gone down in Montreal. It's gone up slightly in Toronto. It's gone up slightly in Calgary. But the beneficiary has been these smaller communities. So in my opinion, the system worked because these were the areas that needed the immigrants the most. Now, retention, we'll talk about that. But just in general, they have been attracting immigrants at a much higher rate than Toronto and Calgary. And so that is really good news. Now, when you restrict immigrants, and they're talking about going back to 375,000, which will take us back to 2015 numbers. So we're going to go back a full decade. You go back to 375, what's going to happen? The risk here is that you'll get right back to the way it was before. So Toronto might not attract that many immigrants, but people moving into Moncton will move to Toronto, right? Because they'll come to Moncton and somebody will say, oh, there's lots of jobs in Toronto. And so they'll move to Toronto. So you'll end up with Toronto, Calgary, Vancouver getting all the immigrants, and all of these secondary cities and communities that need it the most won't get any or get very few because you've constricted or squeezed the top line number. So at the end of the day, what you really need is a system that says, okay, Toronto is it's the Gotham of Canada. It's the biggest urban center by far. How many immigrants do you need? Take as many as you need, but make sure there's enough left over for Summerside, Charlottetown, St. John's, Newfoundland, et cetera, right? And that's what I risk. That's what I worry about. When you restrict those numbers, what's going to happen is people are going to end up moving from other parts of Canada into Toronto, Calgary, and so on. And you're going to end up with the situation where you had before, where all these smaller communities are going to struggle because they don't have the population base. And maybe the government is saying, well, no, they'll all stay in Yarmouth. They won't move to Toronto. Yeah, maybe. Again, it's the most, it's like saying immigrants aren't going to move to New York or LA, right? Really? Yeah. Maybe. Good luck.
You raise an important point when you talked about our structural realities. Because I feel like that thing is one thing a lot of people just kind of just ignore when they talk about Canada, immigration, and compare us to other countries. But also, I also think that there's also a point to be made about some people say, or you should think about it, some people would say, oh, we've used immigration to paper over our structural economic weaknesses, you know, like literally the trade barriers, the regional differences that we haven't yet somehow found a way to bring together and all that. Is that a fair assessment? What's a better way to think of that, have that conversation?
I think one of the things is to look at numbers and not percentages. So I wrote the other day.
Oh, I love that.
Again, the United States, which is smaller than Canada, geographically smaller than Canada, brought in 59 million people since 2000. So more than the population of Italy, more than the population of France in 24 years, okay? Canada over that same period brought in, I don't know, 9 or 10. So, I mean, you know, that's the bottom line, right? So the U.S. can bring in 59 million immigrants and drive massive economic growth across the entire country. Places like Nevada and New Mexico and Texas, all growing strong. Now, by the way, a third of those immigrants were illegal, you know, and the Americans just looked the other way because they needed them. So they said, okay, you know, you're illegal, but we're happy to have you work in our fields. But at the end of the day, they brought in nearly 60 million immigrants. Now, what if Canada had brought in 60 million immigrants? Right? Now, we talked about earlier how it's hard to support that level of immigration, but as a general rule, we're larger than the U.S. physically, and we brought in a fraction of the immigrants in actual numbers compared to the U.S. So the reason I raise that is because the people that keep saying this business about immigration and our rates so high compared to the U.S. or the U.K., we have a totally different reality here. We have a totally different reality. We have a very sparsely populated country, and we can handle and should look at immigration policy based on the needs of provinces. So if you restrict immigrants and they only go to Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver again, what have you done for the rest of the country? So we still have to do that. Now, this issue that immigration is papering over other challenges or problems or economic weakness, again, you know, you have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Population, workforce needs to be looked at as an input, the same as capital, the same as agricultural land, the same as natural resources. These are inputs to economic development. And what we've seen across the country since 2008 is an economy that's growing at less than half of what it grew before 2008 on an average annual basis. That's real inflation-adjusted GDP. So everybody's saying, well, we got to get back to 2.5 or 3% GDP growth in order to support this massive social safety net, this, you know, the healthcare system, the education system, the pension system, all of that stuff. We got to get back up to 3% growth. Well, how do you get back up to 3% growth without at least a modest growth, let's say 2% in your workforce? You know, there's just no way. I've looked at the numbers back and forth, and I think what's going to happen in the U.S. is they're going to figure that out too. They just grew in the last year. And by the way, it really wasn't the last year. It was the last 6 months because it was between the population numbers are for July 1, so it's only halfway through Trump's term, and the population only grew by 0.5% in the U.S. And I think it's going to even go less than that when when the calendar year numbers come out, it's going to be even less than that. And I think what's going to happen is the Americans are going to realize in a hurry that they're going to have to let more immigrants in. And Trump is even talking about that, letting in the right ones he wants more from Sweden, right, and from Norway. And by the way, those countries are never going to send immigrants in any volume to the U.S. But so I think they're going to figure that out. So Canada needs, if we want to grow our GDP at 3 and you're not growing your workforce at 1.5 or 2, I don't see how that works in the long run. So we have to be able to figure this out. We're going through a bit of a hiccup now. You know, people are, you know, Alberta's funny, right? They're talking about separating and a lot of them are like, oh, well, we don't look like we used to look like, and, you know, we don't have as many cowboys anymore. So if you go to Edmonton, like it's a very multicultural place. You know, almost all the population growth in Edmonton has come from immigrants. And it's a beautiful, multicultural, multi-ethnic place. And what do you want to do? You want to go back to the days where there's just all white cowboys? It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless you can attract them all from Texas. Anyway, it's so frustrating. You know, they will separate from, let's say they separate from Canada. Let's say Alberta separates from Canada. They have their referendum. They separate from Canada. They're still going to need immigrants to support their economic growth. So they're still going to be a multicultural place. They need to embrace that. All the old people that are nervous about the future, they need to think about their children. They need to think about their own prospects, and they need to understand that Alberta needs a moderate level of newcomers and immigrants to support workforce demand in the future. And that's exactly what they've been doing. Edmonton is a great example of a multicultural city.
Oh yeah,
Calgary, yes, but Edmonton even more. If you go to Edmonton, it's a very. I've been to Edmonton several times. You walk around the mall. You go to a hockey game. It's a very multicultural place, and that is to the benefit of the multi-generation old white stock from Scotland or England or whatever they showed up 200 years ago.
I'm rounding up. I think I have one more question before we do the book of questions. And that if you were, like, I think, like, especially with all these things that's happening in Alberta right now, and I don't want, I'm worried that this will probably kind of say, give me a simplistic answer. Please don't. If you have to go on a spiel, a long take, do that. But what are the things, or what's the few things Kenyans need to understand about the newcomers and the economy? Like, what is that? How can we make them understand that? Because it just feels like a lot of the narratives that are out there are so simplistic. They lack nuance. A lot of them are coated in racism and bias and fear of a future that you can't even see. You know, like unfounded fears most of the time. You know, and I keep asking myself, like, what's the one narrative that one can say that helps to tell people that, yo, look, these folks are actually pretty important to where this country goes in the future from an economic point of view, from a cultural point of view, from a keeping the future alive point of view. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on how to phrase that?
So it costs society about somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000 in current dollars to pay for a newborn baby in Canada to the time they get to the point where they're contributing in the workforce. In other words, if you take their cost of education, their cost of health care, the cost of public services to service that child, to get one Canadian from birth to the workforce is going to cost society between $250,000 and $300,000. You bring in an economic immigrant tomorrow, not refugees, because we do support refugees financially, but if you bring in an economic immigrant tomorrow, an international student that graduates or whatever, they cost society nothing. So the first point for your listeners is that the economic case for bringing in immigrants is extremely high, because for every domestic kid that you're going to try to get into the workforce, it's going to cost you $250,000 to $300,000. Every immigrant costs you nothing. And plus, they come in when you need them. You know, you say, well, we need immigrants tomorrow to work in that manufacturing plant. Well, let's go out and bring them in. So that is an incredibly important, for me, it's an important argument. I'm not saying we don't invest in all those kids. And by the way, when the immigrants come and have their own kids, society's going to invest in them with all those costs to make sure that they get in the workforce. But just as a general rule, for those people that say immigrants cost Canada, it's absolutely ridiculous. Immigrants are paying taxes the day they arrive, when they study. There's several studies that show that the average international student spends something between $12,000 and $15,000 in taxes, not directly, but through the economic activity, right? They support the professor's salary and the professor pays tax. They go to the store and they buy food. That food, there's HST on that food, etc. They live in an apartment and the owner of that apartment pays rent. If you add up all that taxes, every international student is contributing between $12,000 and $15,000 in tax revenue every year to the treasuries of the provincial, local, and federal governments. So even the international students are paying a lot of taxes indirectly. They don't even know they're paying them, but they're paying them. So the economic case for immigration is extremely high. So I think what we've seen in the last few years is that maybe sometimes there can be a miscalibration in terms of the number coming in. But as a general rule, the case for immigration is extremely, extremely high. Now, of course, when you have, you know, Canada's always been an exploration of multiculturalism. So we do need immigrants. And I've said this a lot, Dozy, we need immigrants. When you come to Canada, you have to understand you can practice any religion you want. If your religion is like Nazism, maybe not. But in general, you can practice, some cult, I don't know. But in general, any religion, right? This is Canada. If you want to be a Hindu, if you want to be a Muslim, if you want to be a Jew, if you want to be a Christian, if you want to be a Hare Krishna, if you want to be a Muni, you can do all that in Canada. If you want to practice certain, absolutely, this is the point of Canada. The problem is you just can't tell other people that they can't do what they want to do, right? So tolerance and openness is fundamental in this country. If you come to Canada and you don't think, you know, if you come here and you say, well, you know what, I just don't think that we should have Christians here, or I don't think I can't live in a community where there's Muslims, you're not going to get along well in Canada, right? So I do think there is an onus on newcomers when they come to the country. There's a wonderful country to live in on average. lots of people struggle. I'm not downplaying that. But in general, if you look at the countries around the world, Australia, if you look at the UK, if you look at the US, Canada, for the most part, is a really great place to emigrate to, on average. But you have to be tolerant and understand that there's going to be people, your neighbor's going to be from a different country.
Yeah.
The neighbor on the other side is going to be from a different country. The neighbor down the street might have lived here, you know, seven generations. Somebody's going to be speaking a different language, right? So it's a very multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multilingual place, and it seems to work. But we just have to make sure that everybody understands that. And I do think, like, when I hear stories of people saying, well, I can't accept that. And I just, you know, I can't accept the fact that those, you know, young ladies and young men wear very skimpy clothing around town. I don't know what to tell you. I don't like it either, but it's Canada. They have the right to do that, right? Now there's limitations on this stuff. So all I'm trying to tell you is that one of the things that the anti-immigrant folks want is they want to go back to some world, some 1950s world, which never really existed, you know, where everybody's from the same background and everybody's the same culture. I can tell you, historically in New Brunswick, the Catholics and the Protestants fought like cats and dogs, right? They did. So, you know, the reality is whenever you bring different religions, different ethnicities, there's always going to be a little bit of tension on the margin. And so what we need to do is we all need to agree that we're going to live in a community with people that have all kinds of different views, different religions, etc. But we're going to tolerate that. We don't have to agree with you on all your policies and all your views, but we're going to tolerate the fact that you can have different views than me. And that seems to work in Canada. So I would just say to both the newcomers and longtime Canadians, we just need to continue to be tolerant of each other. And in terms of Canadians, you know, you're going to see, you know, unfortunately, there's communities all across this country which have a negative natural birth rate. I was talking to one this morning, Victoria County in Nova Scotia. They have 46 births for every 100 deaths. So that community, without some sort of influx in population, will basically die in the next 20 or 30 years. There'll be nobody left, nobody working. Nobody working in the gas station, nobody working at all. And so is that the future we want for the country? So I don't think so. So let's have a more intelligent approach to immigration. Let's bring in people that want to better their lives, want to create a better circumstance for themselves and their families. And that, by the way, is 99% of immigrants. It always has been.
Yeah.
Why would you move to Canada if you don't want to better your situation? You want to move to Canada to worse your situation?
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, there have been some. We know some immigrants that came here and actually things did not work out, and they went back home. Well, unfortunately for some, hopefully a small amount, but for some that might have to be the reality. But at the end of the day, for most immigrants, it's about bettering their lives, and it's a win-win because the community needs them. The tax, you know, we need them to pay the taxes, and ultimately they benefit, by the way, they benefit our communities in many different ways. You know, there's great stories. We don't have time today, but there's great stories of newcomer communities and small communities across Atlantic Canada, just enriching the culture, the food, you know, the entrepreneurial environment. There's just so many benefits to the immigrant populations. And we're starting to see that, you know, we've known that in Toronto, but we're talking small communities now of 10,000 or 5,000, 2,000 people. So I would just say that's the bottom line. There's an economic case. Don't ever let anybody tell you that immigrants are costing Canada. They're benefiting Canada, and they will continue to benefit Canada in the future. We're probably going to need, you know, to get up to 50, 60,000 in population in my lifetime if we're going to sustain economic growth and sustain that public system. People want free health care. They want free education. They want great roads. They want a big pension when they retire. They want all that stuff.
Can I get something for my child?
Sure. Go ahead.
so sorry. Like my wife is out, and I'm the only one with the two boys. They're at home today, and the 4 year old kept trying to come here. I'm like, what do you want? Like, I was like, so I had to get him out of the way.
So is that pretty easy to clip in terms of your production here?
I can always clip and cut out. Like we'll just cut out this part and then we'll just continue from where you're talking about the cities and stuff. But yeah.
Well, I was done. I was just ranting and ranting, but no.
Yeah.
No, I was just saying there's an economic case for immigration, and anybody that says otherwise is not looking at the right data. And they're not clear eyed when they think about immigration. So we're gonna need a moderate level of newcomers to the country. We're going to need to make sure that many of them settle in places that we haven't seen in the previous years. Again, places like rural Nova Scotia. And those communities are going to have to do a really good job of supporting the newcomers. I've heard stories of, you know, every newcomer coming to the community, getting a welcome basket and getting support, you know, what can we do to help, et cetera. And that kind of personal touch, you're never going to get that in Toronto. But maybe you can get that in small communities, right? Maybe that's one way to retain newcomers in small communities, to be extra nice. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I have hope. I mean, I think it was CD Howe. They had this report about Fast and Slow Canada, which I read last year, which talks about what you said about the cities that would die out if we don't change how we're doing this. But I guess like I think the first part for me is just let's have a better conversation. Like let's just have a better conversation and let's stop all this simplistic, divisive takes that keep going, happening. And we're blaming each other. We're like, there's no nuance anymore. I mean, we're adults, please. Like for me, like that's the big thing is because I feel like once we can sort that out, then I feel like every other thing kind of lines up. Because you're right. Like, do we want to be a country where you go to some cities and it's like they become maybe sets for movies because there's no one lives there. It's just empty houses. And you like that is dystopian to think about, to be honest. Like that is dystopian for me to think about.
Well, that's the difference. In many ways, the difference between Canada and the US. There was a time not that long ago, and it's still the case. If you could drive around Detroit, the city of Detroit, and there were entire neighborhoods where the houses were just empty, just completely abandoned. Big, beautiful brick houses because there was nobody living in Detroit. They all moved out to the suburbs. So they're trying to change that now. But the U.S. did not have, in my opinion, a good approach to handling economic dislocation. I think we did a better job of that in Canada. But at the end of the day, that's what we want to avoid. We want to avoid a situation where whole parts of the country are struggling while other parts of the country are booming and people are driving that growth. Right. So, So I think you're right. We need to have better conversations and I don't see it now as much maybe as we saw in the past, but hopefully that'll change because the other thing, when it gets politicized, when politicians actually see benefit from criticizing immigration, you know, there was a consensus. You know, 10 years ago, the conservatives were the ones saying we need more immigrants. And they were the ones when they were in power that were lifting every year the number of newcomers. But when you politicize this issue and when you think you can get elected by criticizing immigration, then it's a bad situation. So hopefully we can get back through a constructive dialogue and get through this little, hopefully small period. Because I think people in Ontario, for example, are going to really start freaking out when they see their population declining. I really do. They're going to be, really? Ontario declining? Yikes.
Okay. Book of questions. So, like I said earlier on, you pick one number between 1 and 291.
How about 187?
That's a popular number, I think. I think I've had someone ask that, call that number before. No. Someone has it was 188. Would you rather spend a month on vacation with your parents or put in 4 weeks off uncompensated overtime at work?
4 weeks with my parents. I get along well with my parents. My father passed away, but my mother's alive and kicking and, I'd be very happy to spend 4 weeks with her.
Yeah, I mean, I would give my two parents have passed. I would give anything. Like, anything to spend one day, like just one day with them, just like yeah. just one day.
Yeah, I miss my dad almost every day. So yeah, I feel you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David. Like, thank you. Like, gosh, like I've learned a ton, like a ton. So thank you.
No, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
Oh yeah. I think I'm going to come back again and call you and say, hey, I want to explore something else. Cause I feel like one thing I would like to know, but I feel like that requires some numbers is, you just feel like Atlantic Canada is doing some work to attract people over the past 1 year, 3 years. And I'd like to see what that looks like in the next 3 years or so. Like, how does that show up in the economy? Like,
yep.
What's, you know, I'll love to see that. But yeah.
All right. Reach out in a couple of years. We'll do it again.
All right. Sure. Thanks again. And thanks, everyone. Have fun.